Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Greetings, friends and neighbors. It is Wednesday, May 24th. My name is Susan, and I am pleased to present today's Cape Cod Times. Looking first at the weather, today will be mostly sunny with a high of 62. Tonight gets down just to 52 and will be mostly cloudy with a shower here or there. On Thursday, we'll have mostly sunny and breezy weather, a high of 59 and a low of 44. And on Friday, we'll get up to 67 degrees. It will be partly sunny. It'll be partly sunny, not quite summer, partly sunny and a bit warmer at 67 degrees, getting down to 50 overnight. Saturday and Sunday will be in the 70s with sunshine and pleasant weather, high clouds on Sunday. Looks beautiful for the weekend, getting down to 55 and 56 overnight over the weekend. Let's look at some lottery results before we get into the news of the day. The midday drawing of yesterday's, what is it called? The numbers game. The numbers game midday drawing for Tuesday, May 23rd. Result was 3971. Again, midday drawing of the numbers game for yesterday, Tuesday, 3971. And the evening drawing yielded numbers 1525. Again, the evening drawing of the numbers game for yesterday yielded 1525. The mass cash number for yesterday was 2, 13, 14, 17, and 22. Again, that's mass cash for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2, 13, 14, 17, and 22. And finally, we'll go down to Lucky for Life. For Tuesday, May 23rd, the numbers were 16, 22, 24, 26, 27, and bonus number 8. Once again, Lucky for Life. For yesterday, Tuesday, May 23rd, numbers 16, 22, 24, 26, 27, and bonus number 8. Turning now to the front page of today's Cape Cod Times, the headline article above the fold is entitled The Great Streets, Proposals Unveiled to Make Downtown Hyannis Safer and More Vibrant. It's written by Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline, Hyannis. A walkable heart for Cape Cod? The final recommendations from consultants Santec and Speck and Associates to transform downtown Hyannis into a safer, more vibrant, and pedestrian-friendly place were unveiled May 17th in Barnstable Town Hall. A 15-foot mural showed some suggested changes to the area bordered by North and South Streets, Lewis Bay Road, and the Rotary at West Main Street. The Great Streets Downtown Hyannis proposals include turning Main Street, North Street, South Street, Old Colony Road, and Ocean Street into two-way roads, repainting traffic lanes to make them 10 feet wide, replacing traffic signals with stop signs, creating bicycle lanes and buffer zones, adding 33 loading zones for delivery trucks, and reconfiguring the North Street parking lot to add 45 spaces. The changes would require a lot of paint, according to Jason Schreiber with Santec. The elimination of excess lane space at the intersection of Old Colony Road and Main Street would allow for a green space in front of the Hyannis Transportation Center. Painted curbs would narrow lanes to provide neck downs to discourage high-speed turns. South Street would dogleg into Main Street, providing the opportunity for a park-like space in front of a few businesses on South Street. The West End Rotary would be modified to accommodate bicycle lanes on the perimeter. Doing away with a small triangle of roads at the intersection of Pleasant and South Streets would allow for a 4,000-square-foot green space without affecting traffic, according to the presentation. Repainting pedestrian crosswalks in a high-visibility ladder style would make them safer. The lanes would be at least 10 feet wide and as much as 16 feet wide at mid-block sections. Turning the six-point intersection at North Street, Ocean Street, and Old Colony Road into an oval roundabout would require a temporary mountable structure to accommodate trucks. This would be a short-term solution. Any permanent change would take 2 to 3 years to design and complete. Estimated costs were not provided, but Jeff Speck, a principal at the consulting firm Speck & Associates, indicated the cost would be significant. The complete details of the report and the rationales behind the proposed changes can be found online at www.tinyurl.com/Hyannis Great Streets. Speck admitted that in his experience in other cities, city staff could be so concerned about the unknown that they delayed implementation of recommendations. He urged people to call town manager Mark Ells and town councilors to voice their opinion. "Delays make you lose momentum," he said. Some downtown changes could happen immediately using the barriers from the COVID-19 measures that were put into place. The conversation about transforming downtown began in 2020, according to Elizabeth Jenkins, Director of Planning and Development for Barnstable. That was when the city put up those barriers on Main Street to help businesses survive COVID-19. The town and merchants considered it a success. "This conversation isn't over," Jenkins said. "The final recommendation comes back to us as a community." She said her department will seek the support of town councilors, adding that with 186 barriers in storage, some details of the plan could be implemented immediately. Developer Stuart Bornstein was not convinced. He was concerned that a two-way Main Street would make parallel parking more difficult, and requiring the use of truck loading zones would make it hard for drivers to make deliveries. "Generally, as it stands now, trucks are often parked in one of the two one-way lanes, but traffic can still flow around them while they deliver their products." Crowds stood at the mural studying the recommendations after the presentation. About 200 people attended the event. Speck said he was confident about the plan, while admitting the six-way intersection and truck loading zones were an Achilles heel. Schreiber urged people to read the full report. He said embracing bicycle lanes and expanding their reach would change the community for the better. "If you embrace this and you have the space, your kids will bike and people will use it," he said. "Be a community that embraces the tourism related to this, because it's at no cost to you. You can change your community into a safer place with just a bunch of paint." Jenkins said the town is working with Santec to come up with final cost estimates to make the proposed changes. Next on the front page of today's Cape Cod Times, the headline is, "Repercussions would be catastrophic." That's a quote. Bill Keating says debt default will reverberate through the Cape and Islands economy. This article is written by Zane Razak of the Cape Cod Times. If the U.S. defaults on its debt, the economic consequences would reverberate throughout the nation. That includes Cape Cod's graying population, U.S. Representative Bill Keating told the Cape Cod Times on Tuesday. "It's all going to have a cratering effect on our economy," he said. During a virtual interview with the Times, Keating called his congressional district, which includes the Cape and Islands, one of the oldest demographically outside of Florida. People near retirement or already retired have Social Security, but also their own private savings to live off, he said. But if the U.S. government defaults on its debt, the stock market will likely plunge, reducing the savings of Americans invested in it, including with their 401k accounts. About 124,600 people in Keating's district who are retired or near retirement will likely be hardest hit financially in the short run. The impact on their personal wealth, what they have in the stock market, would be upwards to $20,000 or more right out of their savings, he said. When the stock market takes a hit, it'll take years to come back. But if you're near retirement and are retiring, you don't have those years to have the stock market reconnect. Keating estimated about 328,000 people who live in his district, that's District 9, which includes the South Shore and the Fall River area in addition to the Cape and the Islands, would experience interruptions in health care. Republicans are looking for cuts to an 18% slice of the federal budget, which includes funding for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Services. Cape Cod is home to the largest number of veterans in the state, Keating said. The normally routine vote to raise the debt ceiling allows the Treasury Department to continue borrowing money to pay the nation's already incurred bills. On Monday, President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met to try to reach a budget compromise. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the country could default before June 1st, though some Republicans, such as U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida, are skeptical and want to call in Yellen to explain how she arrived at that date. McCarthy and Republicans, who hold a slim majority in the House, claim the nation's debt at $31 trillion is unsustainable and are calling for spending cuts in exchange for raising the debt limit. Republicans also want to attach other priorities, including stiffer work requirements on recipients of government cash aid and the Medicaid health care program. Keating said the work requirements Republicans want include increasing the age from 50 to 55. 80% of the people receiving such aid are children, elderly adults, and disabled people, he said. Biden had insisted on approving the debt ceiling with no strings attached, saying the U.S. always pays its bills and defaulting on debt is non-negotiable. Republicans voted three times to raise the debt ceiling without strings attached during the Trump administration, and Congress has routinely raised the debt limit over the decades since it was imposed. Now, any deal reached would need significant bipartisan support in both the House and Senate to pass. I obviously feel we need to control spending on a federal level. The deficit is huge, and at the same time, I would like to see the parties come together for an amicable solution, said Cape and Islands Republican State Committeewoman Judy Crocker. Keating said he has a totally different feeling this time about whether a default can be avoided, which is compounded by other moments such as McCarthy's difficult quest to secure the votes in his unruly majority to become House Speaker earlier this year. The U.S. dollar, which is the standard by which international currency is valued, could also take a hit if the U.S. defaults on its debt. So much of our influence around the world, our soft power influence to avoid war, our ability to protect, to project strength, or ability to impose sanctions, so much of that is dependent on the dollar. That power is going to be dramatically reduced with a default, maybe never to be the same as it is now, said Keating. Moving farther down the front page, this article is entitled Addiction Treatment Imperiled by Reimbursement Rates. It's written by Sam Drysdale of Statehouse News Service. An opioid overdose death remain high across the state. Substance abuse treatment providers say that increasing reimbursement rates for Medicaid patients may be necessary to avoid closing available beds at addiction and recovery facilities. MassHealth and the Executive Office of Health and Human Services are considering a score of rate changes, increasing how much providers are reimbursed when they admit a patient with Medicaid insurance for addiction treatment. Providers are reimbursed for Medicaid patients at rates below 50% below what they are paid on average by commercial insurers, said David Matodo, director of the Massachusetts Association of Behavioral Health Systems, at a hearing on the rate change Monday. Our providers really want to treat MassHealth, but we simply cannot continue to do it with a rate that's not viable, he said. Richard Kurkuru, president and CEO of Cape Cod-based addiction center Gosnold, said his facility does not want to turn away Medicaid patients, but that they may need to close services in order to continue to treat them. In 2016, 65% of Gosnold's patients had commercial insurance and 35% used MassHealth. Since then, commercial admissions have declined year after year, and in 2023, commercial payers represent about 20% of patients compared to 80% on Medicaid. Even though the Medicaid rate was not sufficient back then, reimbursement from the commercial payers covered the shortfall we had on our Medicaid patients, he said. Currently, our expenses for detox exceed the Medicaid reimbursement. This means that there is a significant loss to the organization for every Medicaid patient we admit. This, obviously, is not sustainable. Gosnold is considering reducing the overall detox bed count or only taking commercial payers, something that is not in line with their mission as a rehabilitation and recovery facility. Behavioral health and substance use treatment centers around the state have canceled services in recent months as the Medicaid reimbursement rate compounds with issues of short staffing and increased safety problems. In April, Mira Vista Behavioral Health Center in Holyoke ended some of its addiction programs, including detox beds, saying in a statement they made the decision to do so based on the reality of inadequate state reimbursement, which falls millions of dollars short of the costs required to operate and sustain programming. A few days later in Worcester, addiction and homelessness service provider Community HealthLink closed admissions to three inpatient programs after a state inspection. Members of SEIU Local 509 told the Worcester Telegram and Gazette that the union raised concerns about safety and staffing at the facility before the inspection. In addition to the reimbursement challenges, we have had similar expense challenges. Due to COVID, we have had to increase all expenses, but mostly staff salaries, Kukuro said. We've had to raise the salaries for most direct staff, especially nurses, considerably, in an attempt to recruit and retain them. The state has temporarily increased the rate a couple of times during this period to address this, but not to the extent that we've had to increase staffing salaries. This has resulted in approximately $150,000 a month loss, or $1.8 million annually, in our detox services. He added that Gosnold began renovating one of its facilities to open 33 new beds earlier this year, and the project will be completed by the end of May. But because of the company's financial outlook, they may have to sell that facility to keep the beds they currently have still open and operating. This is the most significant financial challenge Gosnold has experienced in the 50 years we have been providing services, and I'm not sure we will survive if the rate is not comparable to what it costs us to deliver care, he said. Meanwhile, the most recent public health data shows that opioid overdose deaths remain high, and increased amounts of the highly addictive and deadly drugs fentanyl and xylazine are being found on the streets. In the first 9 months of 2022, there were 1,696 confirmed and estimated opioid-related overdose deaths. That's about 6 deaths every day, but it's also about 25 fewer deaths than in the first 9 months of 2021. Last month, the State Bureau of Substance Addiction Services put out a clinical advisory on the presence of xylazine, an animal tranquilizer not meant for human consumption and called the zombie drug for the severe wounds and necessary amputations it causes, in Massachusetts's street drug supply. In Massachusetts, the opioid crisis continues to wreak havoc on countless lives, said Jameson Pinette, Regional Vice President of Recovery Centers of America. Increased Medicaid rates for substance abuse treatment is a crucial step in addressing this epidemic. By ensuring adequate reimbursement rates, we can improve access to quality treatment and care, attract and retain skilled professionals, reduce reliance on emergency services, and improve patient outcomes. Okay, looking inside the Cape Cod Times today, in the Cape and Islands section on page 3, there is an article entitled, Truro Recount Affirms Election Results on Override Question. It's written by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times. A recount in Truro on Monday reaffirmed voter approval of an override ballot question that will fund and staff community sustainability programs. The recount yielded the following verified results: 293 yes votes, 290 no votes, and 7 blank ballots. The May 9th annual town election results on the question had it passing by one vote, with 292 yes votes, 291 no votes, and 7 blank ballots. The recount took place at the Truro Community Center. It was held after 2 recount petitions were filed following the annual town election. Having passed at town meeting and at the ballot box, the town will now be allowed to assess $703,050 in real estate and personal property taxes to supplement the operating budget to implement community sustainability programs, including a child care voucher system, a preschool program at the Truro Central School, and a child care program for times outside the school day and the school year. In regional New England news, firefighting foam contaminates public watershed in Maine, and about 9,000 residents are under a no-drink order. This comes from the Associated Press, Dateline, Waterville, Maine. Firefighting foam used in battling a fatal fire in an apartment building entered the public water system, prompting the water district to order thousands of residents not to drink the water. The Do Not Drink order went into effect Monday for about 9,000 Kennebec Water District customers in Waterville, Winslow, Benton, Fairfield, and Vassalboro. Testing was being conducted Tuesday to determine whether the water is safe to drink. The foam used by Waterville firefighters is presumed to contain PFAS chemicals, a group of compounds that are widespread, dangerous, and expensive to remove from drinking water. But the foam is advertised as being free of fluorine, another compound sometimes used in firefighting foam. Fire Captain Edward Mult says, "While the extent of the contamination is unclear, out of an abundance of caution, Kennebec Water District will issue a system-wide Do Not Drink order." The foam entered the public water distribution system as firefighters battled a blaze in an apartment building for seniors. One person was killed and several others were injured on Monday. Officials didn't say how the foam entered the public water supply. Newer buildings have a special valve to prevent firefighters' water or foam from flowing back into the public water system. The status of such a system on the 7-story apartment building constructed in 1972 was unclear. Water samples that were taken Tuesday morning were being delivered to a lab in southern Maine for analysis. In national health news, the FDA has approved a nasal spray to reverse opioid overdoses. This comes from Matthew Perrone of the Associated Press, Dateline, Washington. U.S. health regulators on Monday approved a new easy-to-use version of a medication to reverse overdoses caused by fentanyl and other opioids driving the nation's drug crisis. OPV is similar to naloxone, the life-saving drug that has been used for decades to quickly counter overdoses of heroin, fentanyl, and prescription painkillers. Both work by blocking the effects of opioids in the brain, which can restore normal breathing and blood pressure in people who have recently overdosed. The FDA endorsed OPV, a nasal spray update of the drug nalmefene, which was first approved as an injection in the mid-1990s, but later removed from the market due to low sales. Naloxone comes as both a nasal spray and an injection. It's not immediately clear how the new drug will be used differently compared to naloxone, and some experts see potential downsides to its longer-acting effect. The drug will be available by a prescription and is approved for patients 12 and older. In studies funded by the federal government, OPV achieved similar recovery results to Narcan, the leading brand of naloxone nasal spray. OPV was developed by Opiant Pharmaceuticals, which was recently acquired by rival Invidor, maker of several medications for opioid addiction. Indivior expects to launch OPV in October at the earliest. As the opioid epidemic has shifted to fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, researchers in the pharmaceutical industry and the U.S. government saw a new role for this drug. Because fentanyl stays in the body longer than heroin and other opioids, some people may require multiple doses of naloxone over several hours to fully reverse an overdose. Scientists at the National Institutes of Health worked with pharmaceutical researchers on a nasal spray version of nalmefene that would quickly resuscitate users while also protecting them from relapse. Testing and development was funded by more than $18 million in grants from the U.S. government's Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority and the NIH, which also helped design the studies. The whole aim of this was to have a medication that would last longer but also reach into the brain very rapidly, said Dr. Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Still, some experts see potential downsides. A side effect of all opioid reversal drugs is that they create intense withdrawal symptoms, including nausea, diarrhea, muscle cramps, and anxiety. With naloxone, those symptoms might last 30 to 40 minutes. The FDA approval comes as drug overdose deaths inched up slightly last year after two big leaps during the pandemic. More than 109,000 fatal overdoses were recorded in 2022, according to the latest figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We are about at the halfway mark on the reading of today's Cape Cod Times. Let's turn now to the obituaries. In Dennis, Edward Alton Crowell, 96, a prominent businessman, benefactor, politician, banker, a direct descendant of Mayflower Pilgrim John Holland, and 11th generation lifelong Cape Codder and resident of West Barnstable, died peacefully on May 20th. Edward Alton Crowell was born May 7th, 1927, the youngest child of Josephine Leach, Chatham High School English teacher, and Edward Everett Crowell, Dennis Highway Surveyor. Edward shared a close bond and deep love with his siblings, Robert, Helen, and Jean, all of whom predeceased him. The four of them lived within a mile of each other for the majority of their lives. Ed centered his life around the town he grew up in, building his family home, the Salt Meadow Farm, on Main Street, South Dennis, in 1955. This served as his residence for more than 50 years. He enlisted in the U.S. Navy shortly before his graduation from Yarmouth High School in 1945. He served domestically in a PT boat protecting New England's coastline. When the war was over, he and his brother used the GI Bill to help launch their own business with essentially a dump truck, a shovel, and a lot of sweat. What began as a two-man enterprise manually digging cellars eventually became Kroll Construction Incorporated. After 10 years as a small business, the company established its headquarters on Route 134 in South Dennis before relocating in 1963 to its eventual home on Great Western Road, where it also could house an asphalt plant. Crowell Lawrence Ready Mix Cement Plant was established in 1966. By this time, the company was widely known for breakwater and jetty construction and for specializing in road construction and paving for commercial building, private residences, and towns. Kroll Construction was also commissioned to reconstruct several golf courses and was responsible for building two local courses, Blue Rock and Dennis Pines, ventures that allowed Edward to overlap his career with his personal passion. He was an avid golfer, with a handicap in the low single digits, and won many local titles. Eddie was involved in his local community for his entire life and held political office from the age of 21 to 82. His first position was in 1948 when he was elected to the Dennis Cemetery Commission. He held office as Dennis Conservation Commissioner, was commissioner for the Dennis Water District for 42 years, and in 1974 was appointed to the Dennis Finance Committee, serving two terms. His proudest achievement was becoming Barnstable County Commissioner in 1974. He was reelected twice. He also served as a director of the Barnstable County Fair and helped construct the equine facility where he drew crowds competing with his horses in pulling matches. Eddie rescued and cared for many abandoned and injured animals. He was a major contributor to the original Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston and established his own scholarship fund for veterinary hopefuls called the Coon Dog Scholarship, following the tragic loss of his most beloved dog. Edward was commonly spotted on the job or in the office with his dogs by his side, sporting a cowboy hat, boots, and cigar. His horses competed locally and nationally in various disciplines, including racing, team pulling, and all categories of the American Quarter Horse Association. A Cape Cod legend, Eddie will be remembered as a self-made man, eternal animal lover, the loudest voice in the room, a generous benefactor, and a vehement doer who could never be dissuaded. He lived his passions every day. Over the course of his long and full life, he achieved what multiple men may hope to accomplish over several lifetimes. Ed's memory will be cherished and kept alive by his loving and devoted wife of 40 years, Debbie Campbell Crowell, and his four children. The family wishes to thank Ed's long-term caretaker, Marilyn Nelson. A memorial service will be held on Friday, May 26th at 10 a.m., in the Congressional Church of South Dennis. Interment will be private. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to your local animal shelter or animal rescue organization. Manuel Barros Duarte, 80, of Spencer, died on Saturday, May 20th, after a courageous battle against renal cell cancer. Manuel was born in Viana do Castelo, Portugal, to Enrique and Maria Daguios Barros Duarte. He emigrated to the United States in 1949 at the age of 5, landing in Provincetown. He was predeceased by his sisters Odelia and Maria and his brother James. He is survived by his brothers Joaquin and Vincent and Raymond, sisters Candace and Nancy and her partner Mike, and many nieces and nephews and friends. He leaves his loving and devoted wife of 41 years, Elaine Duarte, a daughter, Amy, a son, Jonathan, a grandson, James, and granddaughters, Molly and Hannah. Manny lived his life fully. He had a very strong work ethic inherited from his father while working on the Charlotte G. Manny graduated from Provincetown High School and attended Burdett Junior College and Bentley University, where he earned a finance degree. Manny was a successful commercial lender in Boston and Worcester County and earned the title of vice president, of which he was very proud. If you asked him how he was doing health-wise, he would respond with his infamous quote, "I am still above ground," while offering a genuine smile. He chose to live his life as if the cancer did not exist. He still enjoyed many vacations and trips with his wife, close friends, and family. He was very proud of his home and looked forward to many sunny afternoons on his deck. Even in his last days, he could be found on his deck, laying in the sun, gaining his savage tan. At Manny's request, there will be no calling hours. At a future date, a private service in Provincetown for family and friends will be held. For those who wish, memorial donations may be made to UMass Memorial Cancer Research. John Marin Jr. of Centerville died on May 10th, 2023. The obit reads, "Hi, Dad, what a journey. We feel like you left us too soon, but the feeling that your girl left before you did, always pondered in our thoughts that you would follow her steps to heaven because of that immense love you both carry throughout each other's souls. There is no word that could ever describe the love that both of you felt for each other. But we, your boys, are the living proof. This time is your time, and now it is your story to tell. Your hands were able to fix, arrange, and mold anything you set your mind to as you use your hands to show the world how to maneuver the most difficult task with grace and dedication. Serving the Army also made you a true humanitarian, and you have imprinted your courageous path for new generations and others to follow. You are a true hero, and most importantly, always our hero. Your good nature and passion to help others in need led you to the Hyannis Elks Club, where you nurtured many close and lasting friendships, became the exalted ruler, and significantly contributed to the efforts to give back to your community. Your lifelong passion for motorsports led you and Marcia to join and maintain a longtime membership with the South Shore Corvette Club. We can still hear your voice as it echoes through the halls of the house, and no matter how much time passes, time won't impose us forgetting you." And Joan F. Murphy Mahoney, died on Saturday, May 20th at the McCarthy Care Center in Sandwich. Joni maintained her sense of humor and courage during a six-year grueling and painful battle with cancer. Born in Attleboro in 1957, Joan was the loving daughter to the late Ken and Tilly Murphy, sister to David, late brother Kenny, as well as devoted mother to B.J. Mahoney and his companion Brooke, and grandmother to Gabriella and Charlie. Joni enjoyed summers growing up on Bass River and West Dennis Beach with many cousins and friends. Graduating from Attleboro High School in 1975, Joni moved to her beloved Cape Cod full-time and began a career in the restaurant industry. A hard worker, she made many friends wherever she worked. An entrepreneur like her father, Joni started and ran The Artist in You on Route 28 in Yarmouth with business partner Liz Green for a number of years, bringing a smile to the face of vacationers each summer. One of the finest qualities in Joan was her kindness and respect for others, no matter what their station in life. From the dishwasher to the owner of the restaurant, Joni treated everyone she came across with care and concern. She was the type of person to see someone alone at a party and go over to them and include them in the festivities. She always had time for others, so it is no surprise that when she was diagnosed with cancer, her friends came to help her in her time of need. It is said that cancer patients, when fighting this terrible disease, have good and bad days. The Murphy family would like to thank, with utmost sincerity and deepest gratitude, Joni's neighbors at Old Chatham RV Resort for being there for Joan. They made her good days so memorable, and for their unselfish help and kindness during the bad days, during the last years of her life. Thoughts and prayers will always be with you, folks. You know who you are. Also, to the incredibly kind and caring staff at the McCarthy Care Center, truly angels on earth. In accordance with Joni's wishes, there will be no service. Her ashes will be spread at a later date. Moving now across the pond to a story in London, protesters rushed the stage at Shell's annual meeting. This comes to the Cape Cod Times via the Associated Press. Dateline London. Climate change protesters were dragged away as they tried to storm the stage at Shell's shareholder meeting on Tuesday, while activist investors added pressure with a resolution demanding the global oil and gas giant beef up its emissions strategy. Shell chairman Andrew Mackenzie could not start the meeting for more than an hour as dozens of protesters stood up chanting and singing, "Shut down Shell." Several who tried to run onto the stage were stopped and carried out of the room by security guards at London's Excel Conference Center. The activists, including members of Greenpeace and Extinction Rebellion, say Shell and other fossil fuel firms are making record profits at the cost of the environment. Shell reported a record $39.9 billion profit for 2022. Fossil fuel companies have posted bumper earnings as global oil and natural gas prices soared after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, driving up inflation and helping create a cost-of-living crisis. That sparked public anger in the UK, where millions of households and businesses have struggled to cope with soaring energy bills. Shell said it respected people's right to express their opinions, but that protesters have shown they are not interested in constructive engagement. Activist investors brought forward a shareholder resolution calling for Shell to strengthen its goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, saying its current target doesn't align with the Paris Climate Agreement, aimed at limiting global warming to well below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels by 2030. Shareholders rejected the proposal. Shell executives said its climate targets are aligned with the Paris Agreement's more ambitious goal of limiting the increase in the global average temperature to 3.6 degrees. Mark Van Baal, founder of the Dutch activist investor group Follow This, that proposed the resolution, said Shell was misleading investors by saying it doesn't have to cut emissions to meet the goals. "Fellow shareholders, your company will only change if you vote for change," he said. In a bit of national news in today's Cape Cod Times, Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama is blocking military nominations. The Pentagon says Tuberville's actions are threatening national security. This comes from Tom Vandenbroek of USA Today. Dateline, Washington. In increasingly dire terms, Pentagon and Senate leaders warn that Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, is endangering the country by blocking generals and admirals from taking their command because of a dispute over abortion policy. Tuberville, for the seventh time since February, put a hold last week on a growing list of more than 200 military leaders awaiting Senate confirmation. Such confirmations are usually little more than formalities. But by year's end, the backlog of nominations for the military's most senior officers could include more than 650 people, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Tuberville says Defense Department warnings lack merit. An independent researcher, though, points out that delayed confirmations have cascading effects that include postponing weapons buying decisions. This indefinite hold harms America's national security and hinders the Pentagon's normal operations, Austin wrote to Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Democrat who chairs the Armed Services Committee, which deals with personnel. Tuberville's office, when asked for comment, sent a list of his statements, a letter from supporters of his hold, and opinion submissions he has made on the question. In his statement, Tuberville scoffs at the notion that national security is at risk, noting that the Pentagon will simply keep officers at their current jobs until the nominations are approved. Tuberville opposes the Pentagon's abortion policy, which was enacted after the Supreme Court eliminated the constitutional right to abortion last year. The policy allows for time off and travel expenses for reproductive health care, including abortion, for troops and their dependents in states where it is not available. The Pentagon does not pay for abortions unless the life of the mother is endangered or when pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, according to a Navy Commander Nicole Schwegman, a Pentagon spokesperson. From 2016 through 2021, 91 abortions of those kind were performed at military medical treatment facilities in accordance with federal law. Tuberville calls the Pentagon's policy on abortion illegal and says he'll release his hold on the nominations when it is rescinded. Neither side for now appears willing to budge. Meanwhile, the list of nominations awaiting Senate approval is growing. But the Senate's top Republican, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, says he opposes the move by a member of his caucus. "No, I don't support putting a hold on military nominations," he told reporters in response to a question about Tuberville's blockade. "I don't support that, but as to why, you'll have to ask Senator Tuberville." The Senate Armed Services Committee considers about 50,000 nominations a year for civilian and military officials at the Pentagon and armed services. Most often, nominations are approved in bunches by what is known as unanimous consent. That happened Thursday when a number of lower-ranking officers had their nominations for promotion approved by the Senate. But senators can place a hold on nominations, informing the Senate leader that they do not want a speedy vote. Tuberville's office has pointed out that Democrats have employed the same tactic. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois, held up nominations of more than 1,000 officers in 2020 until the Pentagon provided proof that the promotion of Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman hadn't been blocked in retaliation for his testifying against former President Donald Trump during his first impeachment. Duckworth dropped her hold after about 2 weeks. Tuberville's began in February and remains in place. The Senate could hold nomination hearings for each officer, Tuberville has pointed out. Chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, said that could take months and accused Tuberville of holding the Pentagon and Senate hostage. Officers compelled to stay in jobs until their successor is confirmed may not have the authority to name subordinate commanders to combat posts, or to approve acquisitions for weapons systems. The hold also delays officers from developing in their careers because they're stalled in their current jobs. Meanwhile, nomination season coincides with the end of the school year, allowing officers to move their families to new cities before a new academic year begins. This all builds frustration. That's the case with Reed, who pointed out that admirals await approval to lead the Navy's fleets in the Persian Gulf to deal with Iran and in Japan to confront China. Tuberville's action, Reed said, is very dangerous to the security of the United States. It has a profound effect, and every day it gets worse. Austin has backing from 7 of his predecessors, including Jim Mattis and Mark Esper, both Trump nominees. They co-signed a letter calling for the hold to be lifted. They noted that there are other ways to challenge Pentagon policy, such as introducing legislation. Farther down on page 7, this article is entitled, "Largest U.S. Gay Rights Group issues Florida Travel Advisory." The Human Rights Campaign president, Kelly Robinson, says those who pick another place to work, go to school, or spend their vacation should make clear why they're not heading to Florida. This comes from the Associated Press. Dateline, Orlando. The largest LGBTQ rights organization in the U.S. joined other civil rights organizations Tuesday in issuing a travel advisory for Florida, warning that newly passed laws and policies there may pose risks to minorities, immigrants, and gay travelers. The Human Rights Campaign joined the NAACP, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the Florida Immigrant Coalition, and Equality Florida in issuing travel or relocation warnings for the Sunshine State, one of the most popular states for tourists to visit in the U.S. While the LGBTQ advocacy group said it wasn't calling for a boycott or making a blanket recommendation against visiting Florida, it said it wanted to highlight new laws passed by the Republican-controlled Florida legislature that are hostile to the LGBTQ community, restrict abortion access, and allow Floridians to carry concealed weapons without a permit. Those who visit must join us in their vocal opposition to these dangerous policies, Kelly Robinson, president of the Human Rights Campaign, said in a statement. Those who pick another place to work, to go to school, or to spend their vacation should make clear why they're not heading to Florida. Last weekend, the NAACP, the nation's oldest civil rights organization, issued its advisory warning that recent laws and policies championed by Governor Ron DeSantis and Florida lawmakers are openly hostile toward African Americans, people of color, and LGBTQ individuals. More than 137.5 million tourists visited Florida last year, surpassing pre-pandemic levels, according to Visit Florida, the state's tourism promotion agency. Tourism supports 1.6 million full-time and part-time jobs, and visitors spend about $98.8 billion in Florida in 2019, according to last year's figures. Residents in Guam are bracing for a typhoon. Shelters are filling in the Pacific U.S. territory. This article is by Jennifer Kelleher of the Associated Press, Dateline Honolulu. Authorities in Guam warned anyone not living in a fully concrete house to head to safety elsewhere, and emergency shelters began to fill as residents braced for Typhoon Mawar, a powerful storm that could deliver the biggest hit in two decades to the U.S. territory in the Pacific. Governor Lou Leon Guerrero urged residents in a YouTube message to remain calm and prepare for the storm, which the National Weather Service said could hit southern Guam around midday today. She ordered the National Guard to help those in low-lying areas evacuate ahead of the storm, as residents stocked up on jugs of water and generators. If Guam doesn't take a direct hit, it will be very close, said Patrick Dahl, the lead meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Tian, Guam. The storm was intensifying as it approached Guam, and the Weather Service warned of a triple threat of winds, torrential rains, and life-threatening storm surge. The center of the Category 4 storm, with sustained winds of 130 miles per hour, was about 190 miles southeast of Guam on Tuesday and was wobbling to the north-northwest at 8 miles per hour. Winds could reach as high as 150 miles per hour, Guerrero said in her video message, and Dahl said the typhoon could cause extensive damage. The governor has placed Guam essentially in a lockdown. At the island's grocery and hardware stores Monday, people left with shopping carts full of canned goods, cases of water, and generators. The Reverend Francis X. Hezel, a Jesuit priest and assistant pastor at Santa Barbara Church in Dedeo, was trying to visit people at the hospital before it closed to visitors on Tuesday. Before hitting the road, he said, he had trouble finding someone to help him put air in his tires because everyone was busy readying their homes to withstand the storm. Officials warned residents who aren't in fully concrete structures to consider moving for safety. Many Guam homes are made of wood and tin. The triple threat of Cat 4 typhoon force winds, torrential rains, and life-threatening storm surge are all expected for Guam and Rota, the Weather Service said in a Tuesday morning update. Rota, an island in the U.S. Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, was also under a typhoon warning. Tinian and Saipan in the Northern Marianas were under tropical storm warnings. Some people in those areas are still in temporary shelters or tents after Category 5 super typhoon Yutu in 2018. Guam takes a Category 4 or 5 hit every 5 to 7 years. Mother Nature has spared us of late, Dahl said, adding that the last direct hit was in 2002, so we are way overdue. We'll close out with some advice from Ask Carolyn. A listener writes, Hi, Carolyn. One of my best friends, who I have known for over a decade, is getting married. I am more than happy for her, and I really like her fiancé. Whenever we make plans to get together, her fiancé finds an event or something happening on that day. My best friend gives me a choice, either to go with them to this event or to hang out another day, after we already had plans. I have gone to some events, but I really don't care for most of the events or things her fiancé wants to do, so I am always giving up that day, and then I am left with no plans. I feel like I'm on edge, hoping her fiancé won't say anything about the day we picked to hang out. I don't feel like my plans are ever solidified. I'm having trouble deciding if I should be frustrated, because I know relationships change when friends get married and husbands come first. We also have had issues in the past with her boyfriends and spending time together, so I am hesitant to bring it up, but I am annoyed about the situation. Should I just say something, or just let it go and realize relationships change when a husband enters the picture? Signed, Frustrated. Dear Frustrated, pairing off makes people less available, but does not grant them license to jerk their friends around. You should be frustrated because she's being rude. In fact, a good friend who becomes part of a couple will be extra respectful of your time and commitments to balance out having less time to give overall, and to help her own cause too, since dropping everyone for someone else is a great way to end up with no one. The question of whether to say something is more nuanced. What you describe are a couple who care more about themselves than anyone else and offer you a choice as flimsy cover. What you say or how you say it won't make much of a difference if they just want what they want. It could make a difference to you, though. It sounds really unsatisfying to say nothing and just realize relationships change. A better version might be to say nothing and realize she's your friend only between romances. That seems to hit closer to the mark. If that's true, though, it also means you don't have much to lose by speaking up. Feel free to tell her the choice she keeps giving you is lose, lose, lose. 1, agree to do a new thing you'd rather not do. 2, bow out last minute and have neither plans nor someone to blame because technically you turn them down. 3, insist on the original plans and spend the entire time knowing they'd both rather be somewhere else. Again, that takes you to the crux of it. If your friend wanted to follow through on your plans, then she would. She wants to live on her terms and maintain the appearance of including you. Well, we'll close out with that helpful advice from Ask Carolyn, words to live by as always. This brings us to the end of our time together. Again, my name is Susan, and this has been the Cape Cod Times for today, Wednesday, May 24th. Concluding our time together, I wish you all a wonderful day. See you next time.